about 7 minutes past the hour. What do we got for you tonight? Bush, Beauty Queens, the Idaho Potato Queen. I got a bit of everything for you on the program tonight. My favorite part of Larry Craig's denial today was thanking everyone for coming out today. Oh, which was more than he was prepared to do, apparently. All right, listen, let's get it down on the record. I am not gay. Mike Malloy, I am not gay. Although, back when I was 17, I had a very interesting and, I might say, quite exciting experience with a guy who was 24. Ooh. I have to admit, in the moment, it was a lot of fun, but the next morning, it freaked me out. I thought, oh my God, I'm queer. But it turned out I wasn't. At least not so far as I know. So, let me state it for the record. I am not gay. Now, can we talk about this issue? It's been a real avalanche. When we talked about this last night, I had no idea this story was going to just burst open like a ripe melon the way it has today on just about every form of media out there. But can we talk for a second? All right, let's get real here. One of the reasons I hate to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian sadness is because in the first instance, I can be very easily labeled anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish. In the second instance, it brings out from people who otherwise keep it contained their anti-Semitism. As soon as you start criticizing or attacking the policies of Israel, which are legitimate targets, then all of a sudden the anti-Jews, you know, the ones that say, well, the gas chambers didn't do a good enough job, come crawling and slithering out of the woodwork. The same is true with an issue like that brought up by the situation Larry Craig found himself in. The issue here is not whether or not, to me anyway, Larry Craig is gay. Absolutely not. It has nothing whatsoever to do with it. If he were gay and would have just years ago declared his sexuality, not that such a declaration is necessary unless you live in a homophobic society like we do. When you live in a homophobic society, as we do, sometimes if you are in a position of power or seeking a position of power, it's best to get your cards on the table, so to speak, at the very beginning. But in watching this story develop over the past 24 hours, what has once again kind of made me really, really nervous and uneasy is the undercurrent of homophobia that exists even when they're trying to present this as Larry Craig lying, Larry Craig being a sneak, Larry Craig being a hypocrite, Larry Craig working against ultimately his own best interests, yada, 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 yada. The speech he gave today, the so-called press conference, was, that has to be the sine qua non of fall down on your ass, make yourself look like a fool speeches I have ever seen, heard, or am aware of anyone caught in anything that caused that person to be embarrassed. I don't care if it's shoplifting, trying to pick somebody up in a public bathroom, getting caught with a mistress, your name on the list of a madam. It doesn't make any difference. Or, you know, having a little hand jive with your intern in the Oval Office. What Larry Craig said today was just astonishingly poorly thought out and put together. There is absolutely no question about that. But once again, what I notice is this kind of around the edges. It's a little subtle, but the around the edges homophobia. That Larry Craig's big crime, sin, moral failure, whatever you want to call it, was the fact that he was involved in a homosexual, potentially homosexual liaison. As far as we know, in this particular instance, nothing happened, according to the police report. Nothing happened. But around the edges of this reporting has been this kind of, have you noticed it? It's very subtle. Almost just a little ripple here, a little ripple there, but kind of a condemnation of homosexuality that somehow Larry Craig's political career is over, not because he got busted, not because he was picked up in a call it sting operation, whatever you want to, but because he's gay. Not because he's a hypocrite, not because he has worked every way he could as U.S. Senator to prevent people who happen to be homosexual from enjoying full civil rights in this country. No, none of that. But because he's gay. That's the part that makes me nervous and makes me realize that no matter how this issue is approached, a person's sexual orientation, there is just below the surface in this society kind of that smarmy, snickery attitude of, well, that person ain't right because he's queer. You understand what I'm saying? Frankly, I don't like that. I just don't. But I'm not gay. I may have had an experience, but I'm not gay. Okay. We will have Larry Craig's statement simply because I think that we want to play it on this program. Again, not from the standpoint of his whatever his sexual orientation is. And frankly, nobody should care. I mean, you know, it's just that's something that has just intrigued me for the past 40 years at least. When I finally came to a clear understanding of sexuality, that is on a continuum, that is a, I guess in some people it's set in stone, but given the right circumstances, anybody can be gay, anybody can be straight, anybody can be somewhere in between, yada, yada, yada. You know, if you regularly listen to this program, you've heard me go through this. So, but we're going to play the Larry Craig thing because his disavowals, I mean, it's like, oh my God, oh no, people are going to think I'm queer. Oh my God, oh my God. So, how many times did he say it? 4 or 5? I'm not gay. 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 Frankly, Senator, except for the psychosis that drips from every page in the Holy Bible, depending on the subject, you wouldn't have to make a denial. Were it not for some, I don't know, some phrase or some sentence in, where, Leviticus? Job? Isn't it funny that people always quote that instead of going to the Song of Solomon or David, where homosexuality is praised? Huh? Yeah? What? No, you didn't know about that? Oh, my God. Oh, sexuality is praised in the Song of Solomon, but read the book of David. It's in the Jewish Bible, the Christian Bible, whatever. I'm sure the Muslims have it there somewhere too. Read it. Read about David. King David. Jesus's forebearer. Maybe you shouldn't. So anyway, we have quite a bit to cover tonight, and Larry Craig is just this poor senator is just one of the areas that we're going to talk about tonight. So do stick around. We have we're going to play the little South Carolina beauty queen. What she said the other night when she was asked why she thinks so many American kids can't find the United States on a map. Oh, period. My, period. God, period.
Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these. The siren of the ambulance, the deadpan of the cops. Shot to mark the outline where the boy first dropped. Beware the Holy Trinity, church and state and law. For every death the virus gets more deadly than before. Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these. Homophobia.
Yeah. The next best thing to an impeachment hearing, it's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
Past the hour, somebody sent this to me, and I wish I had it. It's I wish I had the name. It's an article that appeared at truthout.org, and he has a quote at the end. The author, J.P. Briggs, Dr. J.P. Briggs, has a quote at the end, and it's the quote that caught my attention. Here's the quote, and this is from Bill Moyers. One of the biggest changes in politics in my lifetime is that the delusional is no longer marginal. It has come in from the fringe to sit in the seat of power in the Oval Office and in Congress. For the first time in our history, ideology and theology hold a monopoly of power in Washington. Theology asserts propositions that cannot be proven true. Ideologues hold stoutly to a worldview despite being contradicted by what is generally accepted as reality. When ideology and theology couple, their offspring are not always bad, but they are always blind. And there is the danger. Voters and politicians alike, oblivious to the facts. Bill Moyers. Oh, and by the way, Moyers is an ordained Baptist minister. This is from a couple of days ago from WESH television in Daytona Beach. WESH.com is their website. And it says here, members of the 1st Battalion, 265 Air Defense Artillery, have mobilized and are on a plane headed first to Fort Bliss, then for federal active duty in the nation's capital. Active duty? The troops will be deployed for a year. Jessica Ward, whose father is being deployed, said, it's going to be all right. It's okay if he helps people and everything, and it's his job. He's got to do it. He's just got to do it. End quote. Jessica speaks for many when she talks about her father's deployment. Michael Ward and company are leaving for a year, and that weighs heavily on families. The 265th Air Defense Artillery is part of Operation Noble Eagle. Remember that. Operation Noble Eagle. They are ordered by the president to the nation's capital, where they will operate high-tech weapons systems against any potential air threat. Families may get one or two opportunities to see loved ones during this year-long deployment, but it's not encouraged. Though the soldiers are staying in the States, they are on serious business. Really? Let's see. What? This was back on Friday, I believe. Friday? 1st Battalion, 265th Air Defense Artillery, put on active duty and sent to Washington, D.C. Now, what's going to be happening in Washington, D.C. over the next, I don't know, let's pick a date. September 15th. What's happening then? Ah, that's right. There's a big impeachment rally. Here's a little good news. Kathy in Green Bay, Wisconsin, sent this in. British Petroleum, this is from the Chicago Tribune, BP backed down Thursday from its plans to dump more pollution into Lake Michigan, but critics want the oil giant to ensure its promises are legally binding. Responding to a month of unrelenting criticism from politicians and the public, BP pledged it will not invoke provisions of a new permit that allows the largest oil refinery in the Midwest to release significantly more ammonia and suspended solids into the lake. Well, I don't see anything here, Kathy, that talks about the mercury they were going to dump in. But the Chicago Tribune is reporting The decision is a victory for opponents who argued the permit that they were going to use undercuts decades of efforts to clean up Lake Michigan, a source of drinking water for Chicago and scores of other communities. Bob Malone, chairman of BP America, flew to Chicago to deliver the news personally to Mayor Richard Daley, one of several politicians who said the company's initial plans were unacceptable to the public. I still don't see anything here. City officials gave BP a report last week, Chicago city officials, listing technologies in use at other refineries that dramatically reduce ammonia and solids pollution. The report concluded that BP could upgrade their refinery's water treatment plant for less than $40 million. Oh my God, $40 million. What is that, about 2 hours of profit? So, it appears the permit allows BP to put an average of 1,500 pounds of ammonia and 5,000 pounds of suspended solids into the lake every day. The amount of solids, tiny sludge particles that pass through water treatment filters, is the maximum allowed under federal guidelines. Yada yada, but I don't see anything here about mercury. Hello? Mercury? Don't see a thing.
If not arsenic in the water, I'd be worried about.
It's about 25 before the hour. All right, now I realize this may break the carefully constructed tension that we've put into the program so far this evening. But we want to bring you now Miss Teen South Carolina candidate. I believe she finally wound up as third runner-up, which in non-pageant speak means she came in fourth. But she is, in this little sound clip we're going to play for you, maybe you've seen it, but she's having the blonde moment of a lifetime on national television. It was so astonishing that they had her on NBC Today's show this morning to give her a second chance to answer the question. At least here's a replacement for too much cappuccino Perino if, you know, she retires.
Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much, South Carolina.
Right, and then they applauded her. Oh, God. Oh. If you haven't seen the video, and I know you have, you folks are way ahead of me. We don't come on the air until 9 o'clock Eastern. Well, the video on YouTube has gotten 4 million hits. I think they just put it up this morning. Oh, my God. Hey, I've got something for you. This comes from a local newspaper here in Atlanta, Creative Loafing. The writer is Andisha Nuawi, and he has a column every week in Creative Loafing entitled "Don't Panic, Your War Questions Answered." This week he asked a question: who is Victor Boot? B-O-U-T, Victor Boot. Okay, for several months now, the White House and the Pentagon have been telling the American public Iran is responsible for the deaths of hundreds of American troops in Iraq. According to the U.S. government, according to media reports, and according to two Iraq war veterans, I've spoken to. Militants in Iraq frequently attack American vehicles with Iranian-made explosives specially formed to penetrate armor. Asked earlier this year whether he thought the Iranian government was responsible for sending the weapons to Iraq, President Bush offered this sarcastic reply, "What's worse, did the government know or the government didn't know?" Oh, snap! How would the Iranian Ministry of Snappy Comebacks ever top that? Turns out it doesn't need to. Last month, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported the Pentagon lost 30% of the weapons it sent to Iraq between 2004 and 2007. That's 80,000 pistols, 110,000 AK-47 rifles purchased for Iraq's military and police services, gone missing. What happened to these weapons? If the Pentagon knows, it isn't saying. They may be sitting in a warehouse somewhere. They may be in crates with checkered tablecloths on top being used as dinner tables. Or they may be in the hands of Iraqi insurgents and militia fighters, the people sending American soldiers and Marines home on stretchers and in coffins. And the worst part? The Pentagon should have known its methods of funneling resources into Iraq were so insecure that a major security breach, such as 190,000 weapons going missing, was inevitable. The military doesn't have enough transport capacity to move people, arms, equipment, food, and fuel around on its own. It relies on private shippers. Among them is a man named Victor Boot, thought to be one of the world's preeminent black market weapons merchants. Born in Tajikistan of Russian parents, Boot came to prominence in the late 1990s for arming brutal civil wars in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Angola, the wars that introduced the phrase blood diamond into our vocabularies. He reportedly owns a large fleet of cargo aircraft and has a reputation for being able to get large amounts of almost every weapon imaginable to the remotest locations. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have been complaining about him for nearly a decade. A guest on an August 4, 2001 CNN program called him, quote, a kingpin in the illegal arms trade, end quote. For a while in the 1990s, Boot armed the anti-Taliban forces of the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. Then in 1995, one of his planes was reportedly captured by Taliban forces. What some people might have considered a problem, Boot's organization considered an opportunity. Western intelligence agencies believe Boot used his group's encounter with the Taliban to make an arms deal. He switched sides and reportedly sold some $50 million worth of weapons to the Taliban in the late 90s and early 2000s. In other words, Boot was arming the people who sheltered the terrorists who executed 9/11. After 9/11, the U.S. government went after Boot. The Treasury Department tried to shut him down by going after his money. Apparently, the Pentagon didn't get the memo. Pentagon contractors hired Boot's planes to move equipment in and out of Baghdad. Let me repeat that. Pentagon contractors hired Boot's planes to move equipment in and out of Baghdad. Among the cargo Boot's planes were supposed to have shipped, guns for the Iraqi military and the police. In other words, the Pentagon paid a well-known double dealer who sold tanks and guns to the Taliban to fly weapons into Iraq. At the same time, the Treasury Department was trying to shut him down. How many of the missing 190,000 guns were shipped by Boot is unclear. What's clear, however, is that the missing 190,000 weapons is just the tip of an iceberg. Washington Post reporter Douglas Farah and LA Times reporter Stephen Brown have just co-authored a book about Boot that claims the United States paid him to ship 200,000 AK-47s to Iraq from Bosnia starting in 2004. The GAO and the Pentagon now have no clue where those weapons are. The book is titled, appropriately, Merchant of Death. Oh, my God! And in Bush's ongoing efforts to provoke the Iranians into some sort of incident that would result in Bush being able to launch a nuclear strike or several against Iran, this today, according to BBC, seven Iranians working for the Iranian Electric Ministry have been arrested by U.S. forces in Baghdad. According to the Iranian embassy, a spokesman told the BBC the embassy had contacted the Iraqi Ministry of Foreign Affairs and would send a formal protest later in the morning. He said the Iranians were in Baghdad in connection with the building of a power station. The group was detained at the Sheraton Hotel where they were staying. Yeah. Video footage showed soldiers leading a group of men blindfolded and handcuffed out of the hotel in central Baghdad. It has a familiar flavor to it, doesn't it? Other soldiers were seen leaving the hotel carrying what appears to be luggage and a laptop computer bag. The arrest came shortly after a speech by U.S. President George W. Bush in which he criticized Iranian interference in Iraq. Tension between the U.S. and Iran is running high, with the U.S. accusing Iran of providing arms, money, and military training to Shia insurgents in Iraq. Yada, 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 yada. So, seven Iranians working for the Iranian Electricity Ministry. Iraq is not supposed to have electricity. Iraq is supposed to be a failed state. So that Ari Fleischer can lobby for the overthrow of Maliki so that we can get Alawi in, who will be a little dictator, not unlike Pervez Musharraf in Pakistan, or this twit that we have in Kabul, Afghanistan. Alawi will do what he's told and do it gratefully because he's already a multi-millionaire, and this just means more money in his kick. And then Bush and his crime family can put a stop to all this ridiculous, nonsensical crap about democracy. As we have said a couple of times on this program, if Bush wants to attempt to establish democracy in the Middle East, I have five countries that are not failed states. They're doing quite well, thank you. Egypt, which is a dictatorship. Jordan, which is a kingdom. Kuwait, which is a kingdom. United Arab Emirates, which is a collection of kingdoms, and our favorite, Saudi Arabia, which is a kingdom. Now, you'll notice none of those are democracies. And yet George W. Bush says he wants to establish democracy in the Middle East. Start there, dingbat. At least those societies are stable. Right? No, just kidding. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Than a flying monkey, more powerful than a special prosecutor. It's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
It's 10 before the hour, and Iran, Bush was addressing the American Legion convention. Today, American Legion. It is obvious that the preparation for the Petraeus Progress Report continues. We'll have more about that a little later in the program. Last week, Bush warned the VFW that if we left Iraq, it would crumble into another Vietnam And you can insert your own irony there. Today, he continued to catapult the propaganda with visions of mushroom clouds, promising that a withdrawal from Iraq would lead to a possible nuclear showdown with Iran. Oh, again, he apparently feels no connection between these dire possible consequences and the illegal invasion, occupation, and destruction of Iraq that stains his ugly hands forever. Listen to this inflammatory language and scary imagery. Looks like he's revving up for another Middle East invasion or another election cycle. I wonder what troops he'll use. Oh, never mind. He'll just nuke them first so he doesn't have to fight them in the streets of Kansas City?
Iran is sending arms to the Taliban in Afghanistan. It could be used to attack American and NATO troops.
No.
Iran has arrested visiting American scholars who have committed no crimes and pose no threat to their regime.
Damn.
And Iran's active pursuit of technology that could lead to nuclear weapons threatens to put a region already known for instability and violence under the shadow of a nuclear holocaust.
Yeah.
Iran's actions threaten the security of nations everywhere.
Oh, God.
And that is why the United States is rallying friends and allies around the world to isolate the regime.
How's that going?
To impose economic sanctions.
How's that going?
We will confront this danger before it is too late.
What time is it?
I want our fellow citizens to consider what would happen if these forces of radicalism and extremism are allowed to drive us out of the Middle East.
Peace?
The region would be dramatically transformed in a way that could imperil the civilized world.
The civilized? Oh, my God.
Extremists of all strains would be emboldened by the knowledge that they forced America to retreat.
I haven't heard the term civilized world.
Terrorists could have more safe havens to conduct attacks on Americans and our friends and allies.
Uh-huh.
Iran could conclude that we were weak.
Weak?
And could not stop them from gaining nuclear weapons.
What?
And once Iran had nuclear weapons, it would set off a nuclear arms race in the region.
Between who and who? A nuclear arms race between Iran and Israel? Pakistan and Iran? India and Pakistan. India and Iran. What is this? Imperil the civilized world? Oh, my God. Iran could conclude if we leave that we are weak. George, all you have to do is send a message to Iran that very carefully, in short words, and maybe use your dark crayons so it doesn't get lost on the lined notebook paper you'll be writing on. Let them know that we have over 16,000 nuclear-tipped missiles, any one of which could turn Iran into marble. Oh, but they might think we're weak. The region would be dramatically transformed in a way that could imperil the civilized world. Oh, Jesus, no, not that. The civilized world, as opposed to imperil the civilized world. I haven't heard that expression since 1954. Just one more from the Frightener-in-Chief about Iran's evil intentions on Iraq. Of course, he made Iraq vulnerable to Iran with his massacre there, but he created a vacuum for all kinds of violent factions to invade and... Oh, never mind.
Imagine an Iraq where militia groups backed by Iran control large parts of the country.
No!
Imagine an Iraq where Al-Qaeda has established sanctuaries to safely plot future attacks on targets all over the world. Including America.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
We've seen what these enemies will do when American forces are actively engaged in Iraq.
What? What?
And we can envision what they would do if they were emboldened by American forces in retreat.
Emboldened? Oh, don't let them be.
The attacks on our bases and our troops by Iranian-supplied munitions have increased in the last few months.
It's up to one already.
Despite pledges by Iran to help stabilize the security situation in Iraq.
That's a filthy lie. They're not going to do that.
Some say Iran's leaders are not aware of what members of their own regime are doing.
Really?
Others say Iran's leaders are actively seeking to provoke the West. Either way, they cannot escape responsibility for aiding attacks against coalition forces and the murder of innocent Iraqis.
Well, we don't do that.
The Iranian regime must halt these actions.
Yes!
And until it does,
yeah,
I will take actions necessary to protect our troops.
Damn right!
I have authorized our military commanders in Iraq to confront Tehran's murderous activities.
Yes! 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 Yes!
Oh, excuse me. Sorry. Others say Iran's leaders are actively seeking to provoke the West. Oh, yeah, well, that's obvious. They have three naval battle groups off the coast of New Jersey. And one steaming towards the coast of California. Yes, the provocative bastards! Oh, wait a minute. We're doing that. Take that back. They cannot escape responsibility for the murder of innocent Iraqis. Murder of innocent Iraqis. Let's see now. According to just about every global responsible reporting agency, from the Lancet to the Red Cross to the Red Crescent to Human Rights Watch, the United States of America has so far murdered 3 million Iraqis. Welcome back. It's about 6:30 past the hour. Email from Blueberry Pickens wants to remind me that regarding dumping of toxic chemicals into the Great Lakes, which is what BP says it won't do, it has not signed any kind of a legal document, but, you know, it's one of these, trust us, we won't do it. As Blueberry Pickens says, the Great Lakes don't belong exclusively to the U.S. yet. Why is that never brought up in the States? Blueberry wants to know. Americans would say it if it was a Canadian residential multinational. Well, I have no idea why, except we are citizens of the United States of America, and we can't find ourselves on a map, but, you know. Now, regarding the ads that have been running lately, put out there by Freedom Watch, Freedom's Watch, and not the Ron Paul Freedom Watch, but Freedom's Possessive, Freedom's Watch. I believe that's what the major difference is. It's a real creme de la creme, or a who's who of former Bush administration ambassadors to places like France and Italy. One of Bush's original pioneers, a man ranked by Forbes last year as the third richest man in America, and of course, former White House press secretary and prison guard Ari Fleischer. Brad Blakeman, the president of Freedom's Watch, which is running these ads, released the following names as donors to his group. Now, Blakeman told NBC that the rest of the donors are choosing to be anonymous. Why, of course. They want war and death and destruction and more arms and limbs blown off and more dead people, but they don't want to go on the record as advocating it. Freedom's Watch is a 501c organization which can collect unlimited contributions and doesn't have to disclose its donors. How about that? So, here they are, the ones that we know about. Anthony Gioia, G-I-O-I-A, former ambassador to Malta for the Bush crime family, per a White House press release announcing his appointment as ambassador a couple of years ago. Gioia is presently the chairman and CEO of Gioia Management Company, a management and investment holding company located in Buffalo, New York. Kevin Moley, whom Bush appointed U.S. permanent representative to the U.N. and other international organizations in Geneva in September 2001, per the White House press release announcing his appointment, Moley, quote, was a private investor and served on the board of directors of 5 publicly held companies and 3 privately held companies. He previously served as a consultant to Kinetra LLC, the successor company to Integrated Medical Systems, Inc., which Ambassador Moley served as president and CEO. Ambassador Moley was also senior vice president of PCS Health Systems, Inc.
Oh, one of them.
Mel Sembler, whose name we know very well here in Atlanta. Mel Sembler, whom Bush appointed as U.S. ambassador to Italy in 2001. According to a State Department bio, Sembler was most recently the chairman of the board of the Sembler Company, one of the nation's leading shopping center developers. He is nationally recognized as an activist in the anti-drug campaign and as a staunch, longtime supporter of the Republican Party and its candidates. Howard Leach, who was Bush's ambassador to France from 2001 to 2005, and an original Bush pioneer, per the U.S. Embassy's website. Leach, quote, is an entrepreneur, investor, and chief executive. He began his career as founder and president of several agribusiness corporations. He has served as president and major shareholder of numerous industrial and financial companies, end quote. What a bunch of just capitalist pigs. Huh? These are the guys that were caricatured by every socialist or communist for the past 100 years. Here they are. Here they are. You can just see them rotund with their stovepipe hats and their ivory-headed canes stepping over homeless people in the gutter. Right? Can't you just see that? Here's some more. Dr. John Templeton, who's chairman and president of the John Templeton Foundation. Edward Snyder. Sheldon Adelson, a casino mogul, ranked as the 3rd richest American, worth $20 billion, according to Forbes in 2006. Richard Fox, Gary Erlbaum, Matt Brooks, and Ari Fleischer, former outdoor prison guard and White House press secretary. There they are, ladies and gentlemen. A nice round of applause for those solid Americans who are doing everything they can to fight communism. No, not communism. Fascism. No, not fascism. Muslimism. No. Terrorism. No. What is it they're fighting? I don't know. General Petraeus, according to the Washington Post, after reviewing an early draft of the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq a couple of days ago, succeeded in altering the document's judgments about the violence in Iraq. Oh, no, really? Oh, General Petraeus, you little creep. You creepy little apple-polishing bastard. Did you really do that? You altered the document's judgments about the... did you alter them up or alter them down?
The NIA, requested by the White House Iraq coordinator, Lieutenant General Douglas Lute, is in preparation for the testimony, met with resistance from U.S. military officials in Baghdad, according to senior U.S. military intelligence officer there. Presented with the draft of the conclusions, Petraeus succeeded in having the security judgments softened to reflect
improvements
in recent months. The first line of the key judgments of the NIA reported that there had been, quote, measurable but uneven improvements in Iraq's security position. Situation.
The Washington Post report suggests that the intelligence community's initial judgment about the security situation was much harsher.
Petraeus repeatedly suggested that sectarian killings in Iraq are down, touting the decline as proof of security progress in Iraq.
Media reports, however, dispute the claims, and the military has thus far refused to provide its statistics to resolve the matter.
U.S. officials say the number of civilian casualties in the Iraqi capital is down 50%.
But U.S. officials declined to provide specific numbers, and statistics gathered by McClatchy newspapers don't, you know, support that claim.
The death toll from sectarian attacks around the country is running nearly double the pace from a year ago.
But, General Richard Sherlock,
Deputy Director blah, 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 said violence in Iraq, quote, has continued to decline and is at its lowest level since June 2006. He offered no statistics to back his claim. Representative Tom Davis, Republican from Virginia, suggested recently that the White House would tweak the upcoming Petraeus report, but if Petraeus is so willing to alter intelligence findings, it appears the White House may not have much tweaking to do after all. Oh, my God. That's from thinkprogress.org via our North Metro Atlanta military correspondent, Sharon. So, the apple-polishing little swine, General David Petraeus.
Oh, he's a genius. He rewrote the manual on fighting insurgencies.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So he's altering the intelligence reports before they work their way into the hands of Chuckle Nuts and his puppet master, Cheney. Gosh. Is there anything at all that any member of the Bush crime family, civilian or military, would not corrupt, lie about, alter, destroy, poison, change, anything. Anything. Weather reports, military results, intelligence. Is there anything? Stem cell research, global warming, anything that these rat bastards report honestly. Quick answer, I guess, is no. Hell no. We'll be back after the break.
Have you seen the little piggies crawling in the dirt? And for all the little piggies, life is getting worse. Always having dirt to play around in. Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shirt? You will find bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play around.
Shuffling madness of the locomotive breath runs the all-time loser.
I understand that the unrest in the Middle East creates unrest throughout the region.
21 past the hour. David Swanson, writing at alternate.org, well, originally appeared at After Downing Street. And carried by Raw Story, I'm getting way ahead of myself here. David Swanson, writing at afterdowningstreet.org, and it was carried then by alternate.org, detailed plans for a military attack on Iran are far more extensive than has been reported in the U.S. According to top British military analysts, there have been occasional news reports on various strategic bombing options, both conventional and nuclear, but this is the first comprehensive look at the full range of Pentagon plans. A new report obtained by RawStory.com concludes that the United States has made major preparations to attack Iran, and that such an attack will likely target much more than just weapons or nuclear facilities. RawStory's article breaking the story can be found at their website. The authors are Dr. Dan Plesh and Martin Butcher. Dr. Plesh is director of the School of Oriental and African Studies Center for International Studies and Diplomacy. Martin Butcher is an international consultant on security politics. Here's some excerpts. The study concludes that the U.S. has made military preparations to destroy Iran's WMDs, nuclear energy, regime, armed forces, state apparatus, and economic infrastructure within days, if not hours, if George W. Bush gives the order. Let me repeat that. Preparations to destroy Iran's weapons of mass destruction,
nuclear energy, Iran's regime, armed forces, state apparatus, and economic infrastructure, you know, electricity, water, gas, health care, food delivery systems, roads, bridges, dams. Son of a bitch. The report goes on, the U.S. is not publicizing the scale of these preparations to deter Iran, tending to make confrontation more likely. The U.S. retains the option of avoiding war, but using its forces as part of an overall strategy of shaping Iran's actions. Any attack is likely to be on a massive, multi-front scale, but avoiding a ground invasion. Attacks focused on WMD facilities would leave Iran too many retaliatory options, leave Bush open to the charge of using too little force, and leave the regime intact. So it's got to be massive, truth seekers, massive, multifaceted, and hitting everything in that country, everything. The report goes on, U.S. bombers and long-range missiles are ready today to destroy 10,000 targets in Iran in a few hours. U.S. ground, air, and marine forces are ready in the Gulf. Iraq and Afghanistan can devastate Iranian forces, the regime, and the state at short notice. Some form of low-level U.S. and possibly U.K. military action, as well as armed popular resistance, appear underway inside the Iranian provinces or ethnic areas of the Azeri, Balochistan, Kurdistan, and Khuzestan. Iran was unable to prevent sabotage of its offshore-to-shore crude oil pipelines in 2005. Now, you see, as Bush talks about how the Iranians are harassing and attacking and killing Americans, everything that comes out of Bush's mouth, remember, is an absolute, utter, 180-degree lie. We are doing it to them. We have already begun this invasion months ago, by the way. This is not news. Another excerpt. Nuclear weapons are ready, but most unlikely to be used by the U.S., the U.K., and Israel. The human, political, and environmental effects would be devastating, while their military value is limited. And the last excerpt here, Israel is determined to prevent Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, yet has the conventional military capability only to wound Iran's WMD programs. So, you draw your own conclusions from that, truth seeker, but it's a little scary. Has anyone heard anything lately from Condoleezza Rice? Has she been kidnapped and taken to Tralfamador? Whatever happened to the U.S. State Department? Remember that? I know it's a quaint institution that no longer means a damn thing. Foreign policy now is run by either Bush pioneers or this sick bastard Cheney or, oh, I don't know, Gonzalez or Ari Fleischer or PR firms or Blackwater or somebody. But shouldn't the State Department be involved to some degree in what's going on here? No? That's a little bit too quaint even for you? Okay, just thought I'd ask. All right, when we come back, we're going to play the minute and 42 seconds of Senator Larry I'm Not Gay Craig, Republican of Idaho, and then hopefully this will be the last time we ever do play, relate to, or say anything about Senator Larry Craig. And we'll also have Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Stick around.
He's the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. All right, this is from today. It's a little comic relief if you take this with the right attitude. If you forget that this country is awash from coast to coast, border to border, in homophobia and anti-gay attitudes, if you can set that aside and listen to a preeminent right-wing Republican gay basher, a homophobe, self-hating, perhaps, man who has done everything that he could, without being overtly obvious, to make life even more miserable for people in this country who happen to be gay, or just happen to say they're gay. You know, whose business is it anyway, when you get right down to it? So here's Larry Craig from today's ridiculous press briefing, in which Mr. Potato Pants claims he accidentally pled guilty to soliciting something in an airport bathroom, and really, it's not his fault anyway. It's that filthy, dirty, vicious newspaper that did it to him.
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport. I did nothing wrong, and I regret the decision to plead guilty and the sadness that decision has brought on my wife, my family, friends, staff, and fellow Idahoans. And for that, I apologize. In June, I overreacted and made a poor decision. While I was not involved in any inappropriate conduct at the Minneapolis airport or anywhere else, I chose to plead guilty to a lesser charge in hopes of making it go away.
But are you gay?
That was a mistake.
Are you gay?
For a moment, I want to put my state of mind into context on June 11th.
Are you gay?
For 8 months leading up to June 11th, my family and I have been relentlessly and viciously harassed by the Idaho Statesman.
But are you gay?
If you saw the article today, you know why.
Are you gay?
Let me be clear. I am not gay. I never have been gay.
Okay.
Still, without a shred of truth or evidence to the contrary, the Statesman has engaged in this witch hunt. Furthermore, I should not have kept this arrest to myself.
But are you gay?
And I should have told my family and my friends about it.
But are...
I wasn't eager to share this failure.
But are you gay?
But I should have anyway, because I am not gay.
Thank God! Oh! We can't have that! We can't have a gay Methodist Republican running around as senator from the state of Idaho! Good God, the universe will collapse! I'm not gay! I mean, if a man gets behind the wheel of a semi and drives a truck, you don't call him a truck driver for the rest of his life, do you? All right? Well, if somebody, you know, and then that and some of that once or six times, you don't call him gay. Hell, I'm married. A lot of people in America would be married and living nice, quiet, respectable lives, Senator Craig, if it weren't for you and your right-wing, homophobic, freak-ass buddies in the Republican Party. A lot of people like to be married and content and protected by all those good things that happen when you get married. But thanks to you, Mr. Craig, so many people in America can't get married. All right, let's do Uncle Mike's story corner here, something written by one of my favorite writers, Barbara Ehrenreich, who is author and columnist and political pundit. Uncle Mike's story corner.
Mm-hmm.
All right, kiddies, gather around, boys and girls. Everybody comfy, got your hot chocolate, your jammies on. It's time for another edition of Uncle Mike's Story Corner. This appeared in the Huffington Post the other day. It was written by Barbara Ehrenreich. Can you say Ehrenreich? That's a hard word. The title is Smashing Capitalism. Ooh. Somewhere in the Hamptons, a high roller is cursing his cleaning lady and shaking his fists at the lawn guys. The American poor, who are usually tactful enough to remain invisible to the multimillionaire class, suddenly leaped onto the scene and started smashing the global financial system. Incredibly enough, this may be the first case in history in which the downtrodden managed to bring about an unfair economic system without going to the trouble of a revolution. First, they stopped paying their mortgages, a move in which they were joined by many financially stretched middle-class folks, though the poor definitely led the way. All right, these were trick mortgages, many of them designed to be unaffordable within 2 years of signing the contract. They were ninja loans, for example, awarded to people with no income, no job or assets. Conservative columnist Niall Ferguson laments the low levels of economic literacy that allowed people to be exploited by subprime loans. Why didn't these low-income folks get lawyers to go over the fine print? And don't they have personal financial advisors anyway? Then, in a diabolically clever move, the poor, a category which now roughly coincides with the working class, the poor stopped shopping. Both Walmart and Home Depot announced disappointing second-quarter performances, plunging the market into another Arctic-style meltdown. H. Lee Scott, CEO of the low-wage Walmart empire, admitted with admirable sensitivity that, quote, "It's no secret that many customers are running out of money at the end of the month," end quote. I wish I could report that the current attack on capitalism represents a deliberate strategy on the part of the poor, that there have been secret meetings in break rooms and parking lots around the country where cell leaders issued instructions like, "You, Vinny, don't make any mortgage payments this month. Caroline, forget the back-to-school shopping, all right?" But all the evidence suggests that the current crisis is something the high rollers brought down on themselves. When, for example, the largest private employer in America, which is Walmart, starts experiencing a shortage of customers, it needs to take a long, hard look in the mirror. About a century ago, Henry Ford realized that his company could only prosper if his own workers earned enough to buy Fords. Walmart, on the other hand, never seemed to figure out that its cruelly low wages would eventually curtail its own growth, even at the company's famously discounted prices. The sad truth is that people earning Walmart-level wages tend to favor the fashions available at the Salvation Army. Nor do they have much use for Walmart's other departments, such as electronics, lawn and garden, and pharmacy. It gets worse, though. While with one hand the high rollers squeezed the American workers' wages, the other hand was reaching out with the tempting offer of credit. In fact, easy credit became the American substitute for decent wages. Once you worked for your money, but now you were supposed to pay for it. Once you could count on earning enough to save for a home, now you'll never earn that much. But as the lenders were saying, "Do we have a mortgage for you?" Payday loans, rent-to-buy furniture, exorbitant credit card interest rates for the poor were just the beginning. In its May 21st cover story on the poverty business, Business Week magazine documented the stampede in just the last few years to lend money to the people who could least afford to pay the interest. Buy your dream home, refinance your house, take on a car loan even if your credit rating sucks. Financiamos a todos! Somehow, no one bothered to figure out where the poor were going to get the money to pay for all the money they were being offered. Personally, I prefer my revolutions to be a little more proactive. There should be marches and rallies, banners and sit-ins, possibly a nice color theme like red or orange. Certainly, there should be a vision of what you intend to replace with the bad old system. Maybe European-style social democracy? Latin American-style socialism? Or how about just American capitalism with some regulation thrown in? Global capitalism will survive the current credit crisis. Already the government has rushed in to soothe the feverish markets.
But in the long term, a system that depends on extracting every last cent from the poor cannot hope for a healthy prognosis. Who would have thought that foreclosures in Stockton, California, and Cleveland, Ohio, would roil the markets of London and Shanghai? The poor have risen up and spoken. Only it sounds less like a shout of protest than a low, strangled cry of pain. Uncle Mike's Story Corner, Smashing Capitalism by Barbara Ehrenreich. You can get that at the Huffington Post if you choose to. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio Network.
Listen, this nation is committed to dealing with poverty. First, let me make it very clear, poor people aren't necessarily killers. Just because you happen to be not rich doesn't mean you're willing to kill.
Son of a bitch. 10 before the hour, that's always been one of my favorite quotes from that empty-headed idiot. All right, phone calls. The number here is 800-989-1480. Let's go to some calls here, starting with Sam, who is calling from Dunedin, Florida, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Mike. Thanks so much. I had tuned in earlier when you were doing such an incredibly beautiful job of going through the speech given by Bush earlier today.
Oh, yeah.
And in between being reviled and just absolutely being so upset, I wasn't sure if you read the part where he had already given permission to his military to go ahead and start bombing Iran. I know you kind of touched on that a little bit later. But
no, he's already given permission?
Yeah, that's in that speech. It's on page 2. Unfortunately, I misplaced my paper, but there's one line, if you print it out, in the bottom of page 2, where he has already given authority to use military action against Iran. I mean, he said that today.
Oh my God, I missed that completely. All right, I'll have to find that.
I wasn't sure. It was the page after he decided that we ought to make an amendment to make the American flag thing that you can't burn anymore. You know, it was something like that. But and then the only other thing I wanted to remind you was that you know, Mel Sembler was the one that raised all the money for Libby's fees.
Uh-huh.
You know, and Mr. Sembler, of course, being on that. I don't watch television. I haven't seen it for 10 years, so. Thank God I'm not seeing that. But then the only other thing I wanted to tell you was that I was at a Democratic meeting tonight in Little Pinellas County down here in Florida.
Right.
And they give the candidates a couple of minutes at the end, you know, to talk and whatever. And I mentioned that I was not your typical candidate because I was going to speak up and tell the truth. And I mentioned AIPAC. And this is a small gathering, you know, 50 people, 80 people. And I mentioned AIPAC and how they've, you know, basically they run our foreign policy in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And amazingly enough, even in a small section of little tiny Central Florida, one woman came up and she goes, you know, you can't be talking about AIPAC like that. You know? Oh, God. I mean, it starts here. You know, you're kidding me, in Waco. You're kidding.
Right.
I just had to share that moment.
That is funny. AIPAC has done more to, and I'm going to be very polite here, has done more to influence U.S. foreign policy, not just where it concerns the Middle East, especially where it concerns the Middle East, but not just there. It has done more to influence U.S. foreign and domestic policy than any other lobbying organization, with the possible exception of the NRA, in the history of this country.
Absolutely.
And AIPAC's sole objective, as you know, I know, most people know, is the sole objective is the protection of and enhancement of and support of the State of Israel. Has nothing whatsoever to do with the protection of, enhancement of, or support of the United States.
Absolutely not. And most of the Democratic Congress people are in their hands. And
tell me one who isn't.
I'm not sure. Well, Dennis Kucinich.
Ron Paul, I think.
Ron Paul.
Republican side.
Yeah. But, not many, though. You know, and AIPAC is the one, you know, telling this, constantly creating this story about Ahmadinejad, who is saying, you know, we're going to wipe out Israel, when that was an absolute mistranslation.
Yeah, it was.
And, you know, I just tell you, when you were going through that speech with Bush, I just appreciate you so much, and I just wanted to say thank you for keeping up the fight, because it's not easy in the face of just, you know, this, what's going on. It's appalling. And there are a few of us out here that are with you, but I appreciate your encouragement in going through that. But I didn't know if you had seen, he had said, I have given authority.
No, I'll have to check that out. And Sam, what office are you running for?
Well, I'm going to run for Congress.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I ran for Congress.
What's your district then?
It's District 10. It's in Florida. I ran last year for the first time. I'd never run for office before, and something just came over me that I had to do something as an American, as a thinking American who knows the Constitution, and a grandmother, for God's sake. And I said, I'm going to run for Congress, and I'm the one that ran against Bill Young, who was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee,
right,
who every dollar bill that pays for this immoral, unjust, illegal war, he signed off.
Yeah.
You know, and he's probably going to run again one more time, waiting for his son. So I'm just going to go give it another round. We got 34% of the vote last time. I'd never run before. We got about 68,000 votes. And so I'm going to do it again, just if nothing else, to tell the truth, you know.
Well, we have a fairly solid listenership from Florida's West Coast inland all the way to, how big is that district? Does it go all the way to Orlando or to Plant City?
It doesn't go to Plant City, but it doesn't go to Tampa. It primarily stays in Pinellas County, which is Palm Harbor down to Tierra Verde,
right,
with some gerrymandering out of Clearwater and South St. Pete. But it's primarily all of Pinellas County, and, you know, this is where I'm just going to tell the truth.
Well,
as this
starts to develop for you, please send me a link to your website, which I will I will promote, and we'll have you on the air and see if we can do some fundraising and at least get folks aware of your campaign. All right?
That's very kind of you, Mike. Keep up the fight, and I will talk about AIPAC as I go on, regardless of what one person in Largo says to me.
Well, good for you.
Okay.
All right, take care, Sam.
Take care.
Send me a link to your website when you get it up, if it's not up now, and we will definitely have you on as the crazy season, gets closer, the election season. I have a feeling that regardless of the party affiliation of the governor of Florida over the past 8 years, well, even now, Charlie Crist, who's a Republican, although Crist is kind of interesting, but regardless of the influence of totally psychotic Cubans who live in South Florida, who want Batista back. Somebody needs to tell them that the old bastard has been dead for half a century. Florida is, oddly, pretty much a red state. And there's no reason for it to be, because most of the people who live there are retirees or poor or farm workers. And the Republican Party works against those people every minute of every day, year-round. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Welcome back. About 7 past the hour. All right, Kathy in Green Bay sent me the link here. It's at whitehouse.gov for the speech today. This is what Sam was talking about. Here's a line from the speech from Bush. Quote, I have authorized our military commanders in Iraq to confront Tehran's murderous activities, end quote. Yeah, I guess we just played that. For some reason, it just filtered in one ear and out my nose or something. Anyway, thanks, Sam, and thanks, Kathy in Green Bay. And I apologize for not catching that. I guess I'm just fixated on Larry Craig's activities today. I really am. Have I mentioned yet tonight that I'm not gay? I have? Oh, good. Okay. But you never know. I know. All right, back to your phone calls. Susan is calling from Oakland Park, Florida, listening on WINZ. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Mike. I also wanted to comment on the Raw Story piece about our preparations for attacking Iran.
Yeah, okay.
Under the Bush doctrine of preemptive strikes on nations that we claim pose a clear and imminent danger to the United States, wouldn't Iran be justified in attacking us first?
Well, sure, as would probably 80 or 90 other countries, but in a dictatorship, in a fascist dictatorship, everything flows one way. And that's, you know, and I think Bush...
You're talking about here?
Yes. And I think Bush defines better than Mussolini, Hitler, Franco, Hirohito. You know, Bush defines fascism better than anybody, historically speaking, that I've ever come across in my readings. He's a moron. He's a megalomaniac. He's a coward. He's a bully. He believes in a dictatorial form of government. This guy defines fascism. So
you think about Iraq as Poland and Iran as Czechoslovakia.
There you go.
The conclusions are inevitable.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Although the difference between Hitler and Poland and Bush in Iraq is when Hitler moved into Poland. You know, they didn't slide into chaos. They set up a puppet government that the Nazis ran until finally they were defeated. Just like when Bush is finally defeated and run out of town, I guess whatever regime he has stuck in these various countries will also collapse.
Well, I guess it's Florida night on the Mike Malloy Show.
And I'm always glad when it is.
Okay.
Thanks for checking
in.
Where'd Susan go? There you are. What were you going to say, Susan?
What state in the of the 50 is more interesting or weird than Florida?
Not. It is the weirdest, most interesting state in all 50. Anytime I go down there, I usually come back. No matter for how long, I have family in Florida. When I come back, I'm usually babbling to myself for at least 2 weeks after. And have to up my dosage of whatever drugs I happen to be on.
Imagine what we sane people go through.
I hear you. Thanks, Susan.
Okay.
All right.
Good
take
night.
Care. Take care. Appreciate your call. Who's the writer who writes a column for the Miami Herald? Carl Hiaasen, who has written about 8 or 9 books. Kathy has read every single Carl Hiaasen book, I think, except maybe, possibly, perhaps the last one. I have only read one. But Florida is more a state of mind. I have a couple of daughters and a couple of grandkids that live down there, and it's stunning to me that they actually live there. Although they feel the same about my living in the buckle of the Bible Belt, so, you know. Gregory.
Daddy's with a girl and a girl no more.
Is, well, it's
Bruce Luce and Flipper.
I don't know where Gregory's calling from, but get rid of him, will you? Thank you. Who's next? Jake is calling from Arcata, California, listening on KGOA. Hey, Jake.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. How are you?
Oh, pretty good, especially seeing that Larry Craig is going to have to resign pretty soon. You know, this guy, this is the whole point about why Craig is being made into a laughingstock by everybody calling in tonight, and even the mainstream media is getting on board on this one. Because Larry Craig is completely self-righteous, a total hypocrite. This guy gets on the Senate floor and talks about how gays getting married is going to destroy traditional family values, how letting gay people in the military will, you know, destroy military morale. And he was out front, Larry Craig was out front saying Bill Clinton should be removed from office because of his affair with Monica Lewinsky. You know what? I don't recall any Democratic politicians trying to pick up on undercover officers in airport bathrooms, Mike.
Maybe he was afraid that black people in the bathroom were going to beat him up if he didn't make a pass. I mean, that's what the Republican lawmaker in Florida said. I am always, and I'm sure you are too, most people are, leery, extremely leery and suspicious of people who display this moral self-righteousness or who scream about, you know, I remember, what's his name, Jimmy Swaggart, the preacher out of New Orleans who, not New Orleans, but near New Orleans, Shreveport, I guess, whatever, who screamed about the sins of the flesh until it was revealed that he had regular liaisons with hookers, no offense to sex workers, regular liaisons with hookers, doing all sorts of fun things. And not that there's anything wrong with that. It is the fact that Jimmy Swaggart was such a hypocritical son of a bitch, and with these, it invariably, I mean, it never, ever, ever fails. Wait till it turns out that Mitch McConnell is some kind of a strange character who is married to Elaine Chao simply as she's the beard, and Mitch McConnell turns out to be gay simply because these people cannot accept the reality of who they are, of, you know, demonizing people because they're gay. Why don't we start demonizing people because they have red hair? I read something the other day that there is genetic suspicion about now that people who have red hair can be traced back to an interbreeding of Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. That, have you heard that one?
Oh, no, that's news to me.
Yeah, well, I watch a lot of the Science Channel because I just can't stand anything else, and sometimes I need, you know, bubble gum for the brain. So I watch a lot of the Science Channel, and you know, they had a whole series a couple of weeks ago when I was dealing with being really sick, a long series about Neanderthals and how they became extinct and how modern humans drove them into extinction. And there was a certain segment that said that there is some suspicion that there might have been interbreeding between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. I guess I'm getting that right. And that if there were such an event, that one of the easily definable characteristics of the genetic offspring of these two species are people with red hair, so-called red hair, you know, carrot tops or what have you. So, you know, why not start demonizing people with who have red hair, redheads? Let's demonize them. Let's demonize people who are left-handed. Let's demonize people who have to wear glasses. You know, I don't know. The hypocrisy is what I choke on, Jake.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is just beyond hypocrisy. I mean, Larry Craig did this to himself. And the thing is, these Republicans, since they can't run in a Republican primary being gay and open about it and expect to win, they're all in the closet. And there's a lot of Republican politicians who are in the closet, and this is not the last shoe to drop. In fact, for years, people have been talking about Orrin Hatch being gay. And it's a real strong rumor that's been going on for years, and I think the media, you know, they need to look into that, considering the fact that Orrin Hatch may be the next attorney general.
Well, that's true. Thanks, Jake. I got a boogie. Thanks. I appreciate your call. But see, you know, I love Jake when he calls in. I really do. I think Jake's a great caller. But see, there we go again, getting to me very uncomfortably close to the line. And I know Jake didn't mean anything by this, but we get very close to the line of saying that somebody is aberrant or not good or double plus ungood because they happen to be gay. It's not the gay part. It's the hypocrisy part. And I'm sure that's what Jake meant. It's this horrific, stifling, choking, gagging, oops, what am I saying? Hypocrisy. We'll be right back.
truth seekers. Time to snuggle up with your favorite screamer. More Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. Uh-oh, I got an email here from the boss's husband, from Shelley. Subject line said, AIPAC is more influential than the NRA. I had said that I thought the NRA was more influential. And Shelley adds, only American Association of Retired Persons, AARP, is more influential than AIPAC. Yes, sir, Mr. Boss's husband. But it makes me nervous. I'm right in the middle of a program and I see an email from the boss's husband. Ooh, God. From Meg in Memphis. Meg writes regarding Larry Craig. Mike, Larry Craig will not resign. If he were to do so and break the Senate deadlock, Rove would surely have him killed. The man may be wacky, but I don't think he wants to meet with a bullet to the back of the head down by a lonely river in somewhere Idaho. No, no, Meg, no, just to point another Republican. Idaho is a very red state. It's the reddest of red states. That's why, except apparently for the Idaho Statesman. I don't know. That newspaper must, maybe Larry Craig's right. Maybe they just have a vendetta against him. Maybe the Idaho Statesman is run by homophobes. You know, I have no idea. Frankly, I don't care. I have enough problems living here in Georgia to worry about Idaho. All I know about Idaho is potatoes. I mean, I don't know anything about Idaho. I'm sorry. If you live in Idaho, I apologize. Now, compare and contrast, all right? Larry Craig's situation and the whole situation of gay folk serving in the U.S. Congress. I think it was Malachi just sent this to me. Is that who it was? How about this? This is from CBC News, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, from August 18th, last Saturday, Saturday a week ago. Liberal Member of Parliament Scott Bryson was married in Nova Scotia Saturday, becoming the first federal politician to marry a same-sex partner since gay marriage became legal in Canada more than 2 years ago. Maxime St-Pierre and Mr. Bryson exchanged vows at a church in Chevalier, the Nova Scotia community where Bryson grew up. The wedding was to have taken place outside, but heavy rain caused the ceremony to be moved to a small United Church up the road. A number of dignitaries, including Liberal leader Stephen Dion, former New Brunswick Premier Frank McKenna, and former Prime Ministers Paul Martin and Joe Clark, were among the guests. Mr. McKenna, the former New Brunswick premier, said, quote, everyone involved felt like they were part of a history-making event. It seemed like a validation of a long process, end quote. Dion, the former Liberal leader, said he hoped his presence at the wedding would reinforce the right of same-sex couples to marry. MP Bryson, who is 40, had refused to comment on the details of the marriage ceremony, and his family and friends managed to keep most details of the event under wraps. Many of the 200 or so residents of Chevalier on the province's western shoreline in the Annapolis Valley said they don't understand the fuss and are playing down the significance of the wedding. Pat Eldridge of nearby Canning said, to each their own. Everyone's entitled to their own opinions and own way of life. He's not hurting us. If they're in love and want to be together, then that's awesome. Love is hard to find. End quote. Bryson is an MP with a national profile, having sought the leadership of both the Progressive Conservative and Liberal parties. In 2000, when Bryson was sitting as a Progressive Conservative in the Commons, he resigned his seat so Clark, who is his party's leader, could run in a by-election. Then there's some Canadian political claptrap here, and then it says, Parliament passed the same-sex marriage bill in June 2005. The vote followed a highly divisive debate that saw more than two dozen Liberals join with the Conservative opposition in voting against the legislation. So you see the difference? I mean, my God. Here, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, a week, 10 days ago, reports on the marriage of a member of Parliament to his same-sex partner. And the people in the area where they got married, it's like, yawn, okay, what's the real news today? Oh, my God. It is, in a sense, of course, and I mean this sincerely, I feel so incredibly sorry for Larry Craig. I really do. Making a grand assumption that the man has sexual identity confusion going on here. And I don't know what that confusion is, and in a sense, really, I don't care. A, B, it's none of my business. But obviously, there's something going on here that if the United States of America and the politicians herein were not such pandering rat bastards, this would never be an issue. It just wouldn't. And married men who are living this kind of weird, secretive life would not have to seek out these casual liaisons in order to satisfy isn't it the primary urge? Isn't sex? Does that take the place? Does that supersede hunger? I don't know. But I know it's a primary urge, sex. So, if it were, yeah, okay, that's appropriate song. If it weren't for the nearly universal homophobic madness in this country, just absolute madness, people like Larry Craig could just be happy as a mudlark.
Love and marriage. It's an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry, and they will say it's elementary. Try to separate them. It's an illusion. Try, and you will only come.
And still somehow it's love's illusions that I recall.
It's a fine looking bird, isn't it?
I really don't know love. I really don't know love at all.
Ah, from my favorite movie, Love Actually. Did you ever see that movie? Whew. If you can watch that movie and not cry, take your pulse. Email here from Ken. The subject line says, Alberto Gonzalez, Conservapedia. There's something called Conservapedia? Really? Yeah, there is, conservapedia.com. Mike, just wanted to see if Gonzo's resignation made it here. If you haven't seen before, note under trivia his Secret Service nickname of the Elephant for his ability to memorize obscure parts of United States law. Oh, buddy, Ken writes, time for another shot. Take care. Ken, writing from Loxahatchee, Florida, where the mosquitoes are bigger than the gators. Yeah, I spent a month one night in Loxahatchee, Ken. I know all about your mosquitoes. Woo! Oh, my God, you people are insane. I swear to God, you're insane. Conservapedia? Oh, my God. Back to your phone calls, please. Freddie is calling from Oxford, Alabama, listening on the internet. Hey, Freddie.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm actually a long-time listener. I used to listen to you on a radio station up here in Jacksonville, Alabama.
Yeah, I remember. That was back in the IE America radio days.
Yeah.
When the UAW bought that old network, and we were on a bunch of small southern stations that were used to hearing, you know, real right-wing stuff, and then I came on, and I don't know, I understand there were 30 people in Arkansas, 26 in Alabama, 15 in Mississippi, and 2 in Georgia that immediately committed suicide after my first program.
Oh, my God, I didn't hear that.
Yeah, well, that was the truth. That's the truth.
Yeah, I used to listen every day down here in Oxford. And I used to call in quite a bit too.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's been a long time. I haven't heard you on the air in a while, and it's nice to hear you back on the air.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's always better to be working than not to be working.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard that. I was listening to your story corner earlier.
Uh-huh.
and I'm going to try not to go into any kind of tangent or anything about this, but I have something that relates to it.
Okay.
I was in the mall one time, and this real estate agent worked for one of the largest real estate companies here.
Uh-huh.
And she was railing about Habitat for Humanity.
She didn't like it? She was against it?
Yeah, she didn't like it.
Yeah.
And and she was talking about how they're building all these homes for, you know. And I turn around, and before she could finish that thought, and say, well, who are they building the homes for? People that can't even afford to buy a home from you. I said, how many $500,000 homes can you build here? And I ran for mayor of my hometown, and they asked me how I would, bring more homes and business into Oxford. And I'm like, I don't think we need any more homes. I said, you got one area here in town, and you got so many homes in it that you can't get them all in at one time.
Right, right.
And I said, it's insane. And when I asked her about that, she just dead silence, man.
Yeah.
I mean, she's just like, she wanted to get away from me. And I'm
I can understand that if she was a real estate person. So did you get elected mayor?
No, I didn't. The guy that's been mayor for the last 23 years has gotten it again.
Are you going to run again?
Nah, I ran twice, lost twice. I've had my fill of it.
Well, I'm familiar with Oxford, Mississippi, but I'm not familiar with Oxford, Alabama. How big is Oxford, Alabama?
Oh, God, it's not very big, but it's growing. We've annexed a lot of areas in.
Yeah.
It's like halfway between Birmingham and Atlanta.
Okay, yeah, you're close to the Georgia-Alabama border then.
Yeah, we're pretty close. We're not too far away.
Okay.
But we're in northeast Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And, when I ran, it just,
Well, what would you say the population of your town?
About 20,000.
About 20,000. Well, that's a pretty good size, yeah.
Yeah, we started out with about 9,300 population.
Yeah.
And then the mayor that's here now, he brought in the Walmart, all the big retailers and all that.
Right.
And he's real popular here, so when you're running against him, it's impossible to beat him.
Well, does everybody in Oxford like the fact that Walmart is there, or do some folks resent the idea that, I'm sure I've been through Oxford, but I don't remember, and I would imagine that when you open a Walmart, I'm sure it was on the outskirts of town, right?
Yeah, it's down. It's on down the highway. It's.
What did that do to your downtown section in Oxford?
They don't get very much business.
I wouldn't imagine.
This Walmart's a super center.
Oh, a super center.
Yeah.
Well, that pretty much wipes out the entire downtown Oxford. Mm-hmm. The small businesses. Yeah.
Yeah, I grew up here, man. I remember, when I was a kid running around through downtown. And it was pretty busy back then, but when Walmart came here, it just wiped them out, man.
Well, what made you stay in Oxford, Freddie?
I don't know. I guess sentimentality.
Yeah.
I mean, my grandparents were from here. My dad, my father was from here.
Uh huh.
And I'm optimistic, I suppose.
Well, do you if you don't mind my asking, what do you do for a living in Oxford? What do you do?
I'm a security guard.
Security guard?
Yeah.
You married? Got kids?
I'm married. I don't have any kids. I have stepkids, but I don't have any of my own.
Does your wife work?
Not right now. I'm trying to get her to go back to school.
Oh, that's always a good thing. Well, are you able to take care of business with just one of you working and
yeah, so far it's kind of hard, but I manage.
Yeah.
And it's like you were saying about these you look in the classified sections of my paper every day.
Right.
Foreclosure notices.
Oh yeah. Oh my God, you ought to see it here in Atlanta.
Oh yeah, I've read the General Constitution. I've
right.
seen them.
Right.
I mean, it's like.
But
you even
have that going on in Oxford.
Yeah, I mean, you got people that get into these homes and get into these loans,
right?
And then after a while, say they lose their job or they, or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and then you know, they have to take a lower paying job, and then they can't afford the they can't afford to pay for the home, and then they get into refinancing hell.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I heard today on CNBC that there are 2 million mortgages over the next, I think they said 6 to 18 months, that are going to, you know, they were these adjustable rate mortgages that are going to go up, and the economists or the people who study this sort of thing say there is no way in hell that these folks are going to be able to handle this, because real estate prices are falling across the entire country, not just in New York, not just in San Francisco, but across the entire United States. Places like Cleveland, Ohio, where they never really had a real estate boom, but it's going to be rough. What's that noise in the background, Fred?
Oh, it's a fan. I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. No,
but I mean, there, like I said, there are foreclosure notices just about every day in the paper here, and And, you know, I've read stories about people being put out of their homes. And
What did your grandparents do when they lived in Oxford?
Well, my grandfather and grandmother both worked for the city. Mm-hmm. My grandfather drove a garbage truck for mm-hmm. the city, and my grandmother worked for the city school system in the lunchroom.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I grew up here. And I guess I'm just, like I said, optimistic that things might change, but I know they won't.
You like, apparently you do, you like the small town life?
Yeah, I like living in a small town. I don't, I like visiting larger cities. I just don't think I'd ever want to live in one.
Yeah, I hear that.
And, I mean, it's nothing against larger cities, it's just that, I guess I like things to be a little uncomplicated,
sure,
which they really aren't, so
sure.
I guess that's what I tell myself.
But that makes sense. Well, Freddie, it's good to hear from you again, and I hope you stay in touch. Give us a call once in a while, and check in, let us know what's going on in Oxford, if nothing else. All right.
Okay. Well, hey Mike, it's great hearing from you too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Freddie. You take care.
You
all right, take care, pal. That was Freddie from Oxford, Alabama. Freddie's a good man. You could tell by listening to him, couldn't you? Huh? Right? He's a good man. Oh, by the way, if you really want all the stuff on Larry Craig's Big Adventure, go to thesmokinggun.com. They have all the information there, the police report, all the this and the that, and the up and the down, and the yamina yamina. And they even got a picture of the arresting officer, kind of a cute young tad. You might want to take a look at it. Smokinggun.com. All right? And just search the site. You'll find it. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Reflecting metal smile. Crown queens and Cadillacs. Waving their goodbyes. This town. That used to be so strong, has inspired many songs.
People who hate, you know what they hate? They hate the idea that somebody can go buy a home.
Not too much longer, Chuckle Nuts. Thanks to Ian Huff, who engineered our program and co-produced out of Phoenix, KPHX, our flagship station. Thanks to Billy Foster, our chat room moderator. Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent. Militant moderators at MikeMalloy.com in the message on the message board. Catherine Bay is the executive producer. Tomorrow night we're going to spend some time discussing the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and what hasn't been done to repair the damage that remains to this day. One thing that is not talked about is the interior damage. The interior damage to the people. 10 before the hour, Gordon in Oklahoma City writes, Mike, it would be nice if you could refer our fellow truth seekers to blogactive.com, blogactive.com. Mike Rogers, who runs that site, has been working hard to expose the hypocrites living a lie and the safety of their closet while doing harm to the millions of us who are members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered community. Blogactive.com. Yeah, check it out, blogactive.com. Mike Rogers is the guy who... There was a lot of discussion over the years within the gay community about the political correctness or the moral correctness of outing folks who are closeted in the society. And to me, being non-gay, the argument centered on the fact, as I think I'm non-gay, I don't know, centered on the fact that in a society that will beat gay people to death simply because they're gay, is it fair? Is it correct? Is it proper? Is it decent? Is it moral to out someone who happens to be gay? It's a very touchy issue and one that I don't touch because I am not of that community. So I can't speak about those issues any more than as a white person I can speak about issues pertinent to the black community. I can be an observer. I can make remarks, but as far as really understanding those issues, I can't do it. And anyone who tries to speak for certain communities and are not part of that community, I think are being disingenuous. I really do. I mean, sure, you can make an observation about the political correctness or morality or ethical behavior of someone, but as far as experiencing what they experience, no, you can't do it, not unless you're part of that community. So as far as outing people, there is that argument that especially the hypocrites, the ones who cause so much anguish and suffering and belligerence directed toward Americans or Italians or Yugoslavians, you know, it doesn't matter, people who happen to be gay, with their hate-filled comments and their violence and their ugliness. And again, I mentioned this earlier tonight, that's why I really felt sorry for Larry Craig today, aside from the comedy, in the old sense of that word, the comedia involved in his statement. I mean, there was some humor there that was just... outrageous, just outrageous humor. You know, starting with his opening line. I mean, it was just like, oh my God, is this really happening? Is this guy really saying this? Oh, Lord have mercy. But aside from that, you know, the humanity of Larry Craig, it was, you know, what was being bartered over all these years. What a price to pay. And, you know, in my naivete about certain issues, I admit it, I'm not very sophisticated. In my naivete, it just seems to me that the easiest way to handle this would be, oh, I don't know, something like National Everybody Come Out Day. And if every gay man or lesbian woman would on a certain moment, on a certain day, declare, guess what? Guess who's queer? You know, and step out. I think the rest of America would just be rocked back on its heels and just go, oh my God, you're kidding me. You mean, you know, once these poor, sorry sons of bitches who just go out of their way to harass gay people, once they realized how common, normal it is to be homosexual, they would just go, oh my God. And I think in one bright, blasting moment, the idiocy of this homophobia that we have in this country would kind of disappear, you know, the screaming nonsense in the Bible, to the contrary notwithstanding. It just seems to me it would happen. But again, that is my utter, absolute, no longer charming naivete. That used to be a very charming way to approach this, you know. Well, why doesn't everybody just come out? Nah.
Nah. So, no time to take another call. I'm sorry to leave everybody on hold. Look at all y'all. Jesus. Jen and David and Nora and Mike and Sean. I'm sorry. We'll get to you. We'll get to you later on in the week. Right? So let's see what happens. I will be curious to see how the news cycles treat the Larry Craig story tomorrow. I hope that they just drop it. Just let it go. Because there will be another story just like it coming up very soon. I don't know who the Republican will be. I don't know who the anti-gay homophobe will be. But it will come up again. And again. And again. And again. So maybe Larry Craig's turn in the spotlight should, pull the plug. You know, cut out the lights, pack up the gear, and let's go home. I'll see you tomorrow night. I'm Mike Malloy. Take care, okay? Keep it lit. I'll see you tomorrow night.